This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Hey everyone, it's Estet Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times editorial board, I'm Katie Kingsbury, and welcome to The Choice, the podcast that brings you inside the deliberations process for endorsing a 2020 presidential candidate. Over the past few weeks, you've heard us interview 8 Democratic candidates as they race towards the primary. You've also gotten a peek into the discussions that happened immediately after candidates left the boardroom. The long interviews and tense debates all culminate in our final decision for the endorsement. After the last candidate left, the editorial board sat down as a group and went through each candidate and argued for or against and held them up side by side.
I want to use this time to assess the pros and cons of each of the candidates and then to talk a little bit more about the criteria that we're going to use in terms of trying to choose who we will endorse. But let's just dive in.
I mean, I think, you know, the case for Biden boils down to a couple things. The first, obviously, is electability. He's making the case, and I think with some credibility, that he is the best positioned candidate to beat Donald Trump. And that is obviously a central issue in this election. A second point about Biden is I think that his experience in foreign policy really sets him apart from the rest of the field.
Tom Steyer?
He certainly has a lot of strong feelings, and he has a lot of money. That's how he got in this room, and that's how he got on the debate stage. And that's, that makes me pretty uncomfortable. But he certainly was right about a lot of his diagnoses of the fundamental problems. But as I think Binya pointed out to him, and he had no good response to, is that he really embodies a lot of the fundamental problems of income inequality and particular ways this country has gotten there. And I think he's done pretty remarkable work in California. And as I asked him during the interview, why not run for the Senate or for governor and at least try to get some experience in government before you run for the highest office in the land?
Mayor Bloomberg, who obviously decided not to participate in the endorsement process, would not come to interview, his argument being that he didn't have enough to say yet, that he had only put out 3 or 4 position papers. I tried to make the case pretty persuasively that this was an editorial board that perhaps knew him the best out of any group of opinion journalists in the country, and that we would have plenty to discuss with him with regards to his record in New York. And he decided instead to not participate and not to answer the tough questions we wanted to put to him.
He, in many ways, I think, is a great American in the sense that he has really reshaped a lot of just everyday life in ways we don't even think about. If you think about like his public health initiatives around smoking in bars and restaurants, he's actually quite liberal on many issues, including guns. And I think his work on that is really to be applauded.
Turning to Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
He checks a couple of the same basic boxes as Biden or possibly Klobuchar. He is comfortable talking about faith in a way that few of the candidates are. Combined with his military background, this gives him a little more depth. He's got some big ideas. His plans for the Supreme Court are obviously something that would take a lot of effort. It would be a heavy lift, but he's not afraid of the big ideas.
Senator Amy Klobuchar?
I was really surprised by how much I liked her. She does have ambitions. I keep saying the public option is an ambition, but she's also put out a $100 billion plan to tackle addiction, mental illness. you know, that's the deaths of despair question that we keep talking about. Like, we're the only high-income country in the world that has a declining life expectancy, and no one's really talked about that, and she has. So she simultaneously put out a plan for a public option and also said, here's another way that we're going to come at the health issues that are facing the country. And to me, that was, you know, really appealing.
Governor Deval Patrick?
I think he's a deeply honorable and reasonable man in an age of politics that's full of unreason and a lot of dishonor. And I think, you know, he was a great governor of Massachusetts, and he definitely sort of has the best interests of the nation at heart, but just hasn't sort of done the work to get up to speed in a campaign where if the most important thing is beating Donald Trump, he's polling at zero and his campaign website is on the third page of search results.
Yang gang. Part of what he has going for him is that he's very self-aware and knows that, like, he's coming into this with not really any experience. And he talked about how he would definitely want someone with more experience as his VP. And I also appreciate that he seems to understand in a way that, like, Steyer didn't seem to, and even a few of the other candidates didn't seem to, of what, like, the average American needs and wants right now.
And I agree with Aisha. I really appreciated that he set priorities and said, this is why you can't tackle climate change first, because I think that's something that we struggled to get any of the candidates to do whenever we asked them about that. The question you were asking them was like, that's going to be their priority. And then in the next breath, they would say, oh, no, that's going to be their priority. And I really appreciated that he said, like, articulated in one sentence why you wouldn't go after climate change first. Like, nobody else could do that.
Moving on to Senator Sanders.
So for Sanders, the answers were higher minimum wage, stronger unions, breaking up and regulating banks again, fighting corporate concentration, creating a healthcare system like they had in countries around the world, providing free public education, and taking drastic action on climate change. And finally, I think we talk about foreign policy. I think the world would probably be better off if he had been running foreign policy for the last 30 years or so.
Should we talk about Senator Warren?
She's a fighter in particular for, you know, the people who need fighting for the most. Her moral compass, I think, is pointed in the right direction. She absolutely oozes competence. She's very, very smart. She's done things. She, you know, is responsible for the CFPB, which is a really big deal, among other things. She understands government. She understands regulation.
I think this is a really good moment to stop and pause for a second and just have a longer conversation around what we should be thinking about as we continue the conversation in terms of what we want. You know, to my mind, we entered this process kind of with 5 points that we had laid out to consider, one of which is, can this person win the Democratic nomination and beat Donald Trump? Whose platform and record are the most consistent with the board's values? Who can be the most effective president in today's polarized political climate? Whose temperament and character are best suited to the demands of the presidency? And who will help us recover the most swiftly from the trauma of the Trump era? And I think those 5 points actually color a lot of the conversations that we've had already. And so I just kind of wanted to remind us so that we can make sure we're taking those into consideration. Does that list seem good? Is there anything we should be adding to it? Anything that we're missing there?
I do look at the sort of the depth of the moment. I've said this in probably every one of the, like, what did you think meetings, but it just, it feels like there's something to harness, and it feels like it's very easy for these discussions to get rooted around this notion of, well, this is how people are, and we just have to, like, we have to kind of whittle away a president out of all of these different poll numbers until we have this person because the stakes are so high.
What I'm hearing out there is that this may be the most important endorsement the Times will make in a long time, simply because so many people are confused. What's gone wrong? What's gone off the tracks? What are we? What's our democracy? Where are we headed? And so they're looking very much not only for who we endorse, but how we explain it. What are the criteria we looked? And I think a big part of that criteria is restoring something that's been lost. You're looking for somebody who's going to sort of bring back decency, bring back bipartisanship. So I think looking a little bit backwards may not be the worst thing.
The restoration for me is not enough. It's not enough because there is a huge portion of the population who have never had the things that they want. Right. And so simply restoring the status quo ante doesn't get us where we need to be as a society. If you told me that that was all I could have, that the only option here is, you know, that Joe Biden can beat Donald Trump and no one else can, and he's the restorationist and that's all we get, yeah, I mean, I would sign up for that deal. Of course I would. But I'm not ready to dismiss the possibility that there is a candidate who is capable of delivering a version of restoration and also has the imagination to go beyond it. And that, for me, is what some of these other candidates at least potentially offer. Biden was good. He didn't, you know, falter. He was everything you'd expect Joe Biden to be. But at the end of the day, it just doesn't feel like enough to me.
I mean, part of how we got to the moment of Trump was, like, the income inequality that is underlying this. And, you know, the left has one reaction to it. The right has another. People in between are kind of going back and forth. But so I agree. I mean, I think unless you address the underlying condition of the middle class and the newly diverse electorate and country that we have, this is not.
I want someone to see it as an opportunity.
Right.
And not just a, like,
problem to solve.
The kitchen's on fire, right. Put it out. Like. Yeah.
I agree.
Well, that's the tragedy of Obama.
The kitchen is on fire.
Okay, then you can remodel the kitchen, right?
And also, just to the extent that what Biden's argument is electability, I mean, this is an obvious point, but the use of that term and its connection to reality is very less than desired. I think, you know, if you look even just back at the last roughly half century, as we were talking about, who are the Democratic candidates who've won the White House? An outsider from Arkansas and a guy, you know, this guy, the middle name Hussein, then, you know, the first
and
black
an outsider
president.
From Georgia. I mean,
and an outsider from
him.
Georgia.
Like, none of them were plausible candidates.
And Joe Biden, meanwhile, is the inheritor of the establishment lane, right? He is the inheritor of who? Al Gore, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, who bombed twice. You know, I mean, the people who we think of as traditionally electable keep losing, and the people we think of as complete long shots keep winning. I don't see why that doesn't inform our discussions of electability more.
More from our deliberations after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sexpionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in LA, binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice.
Michelle, give us the read on this, like Klobuchar versus Warren versus Mayor Pete. What are the political realities here we got to think about?
Pete does not seem to be able to get any traction on non-white voters yet. But again, it's really early. What worries me most about Klobuchar is that she is a little bit entrenched in the Senate to the degree that she might have, you know, she'd have to overcome certain senatorial tendencies on the trail. I'm not that worried about her abusing her staff.
Mara, you talked about, like, you know, one of your top priorities being saving the middle class, and you feel like Elizabeth Warren is really the candidate to do that. And I don't disagree with that, but the thing I can't get my head around is, like, the way she's trying to save the middle class and the policies she's pitching, a lot of people in the middle class don't support, and she hasn't seemed to, like, wrap her head around that or, contend with that in any meaningful way. Like, what happens when the people you're trying to save don't want to be saved in the way that you're trying to save them?
It just comes off condescending. And there just is this risk in a lot of the ways that she talks. Like, if you don't agree with her, you're dumb. And it does actually, I mean, Biden got to this a little bit, and he was obviously talking about Hillary Clinton when he was talking about it. Mm-hmm. But I think that this is true of all humans. They want to feel dignity. And if you feel like you're being talked down to, you know, all of my family and them coming from the Midwest, like, that's really a problem. It's like a really big problem if you're trying to win over people in battleground states. They don't want to be felt like they're being talked
down
to.
Even when I go home to New Jersey and I live in a really blue-collar town and I talk to folks who stand to benefit the most from a lot of the things that Elizabeth Warren is advocating for, they don't like her. They feel condescended to, and they don't want some of the things that she's advocating for. I don't know how you fix that.
A true political reality is nobody's going to get the vast majority of what they're talking about down here. So all of our talk about policy and the details of policy doesn't really matter. What matters is defeating Trump, which was your other major concern.
Well, but some kinds of policy, yes, some kinds of policy, no. Is it plausible that you could construct an expansion of the healthcare system? Yes. Is it going to be Medicare for all? No.
What I meant was that these candidates are very similar. So given that what they could do is very similar, who is the one who's most likely to be in the position to do it? And that's the question, right? Biden and Warren and Sanders are the three big fighters in this. They're the fighters. They're the ones who I could best see standing on that stage with Trump. Charisma is I know it's a hazy subject concept, but it's a real thing. And it matters. Like, Warren has charisma, you know.
I think Klobuchar has charisma. I think it's a different kind of charisma.
It is a quieter charisma.
But like
Buttigieg has a quieter kind
of
charisma.
Which is a concern for me.
What does that charisma consist of with her? That's what I'm wondering. Because I like her very much. I think I agree with you that she would govern this country very well. But what's the charisma that...
The Midwest?
Right now, Elizabeth Warren's charisma has her behind Trump in some swing states.
But it has her 10 points ahead of Klobuchar.
I get that. But I'm just saying, if what you're looking for is specifically someone who is incredibly scrappy, you're looking at one aspect of what they're going to have to do. And scaring people is something they also need to avoid doing. Talking down to people is something they need to avoid doing.
Also, understand, too, that to one thing you said, Jesse, I just reiterate something I say every election season, and that is, you know, we talk about policies, but when people go into the voting booth, they do vote generally on the likability quotient, except when there's extremes at the end, you know? If it's not, it's who they like, and there's a little, you know, there some extreme positions can translate into unlikability.
Yeah. Make the likability case for
it also makes it a challenge for all of the female candidates. I mean, that's just the reality.
So after hours of deliberation, I did what I do with every story, which is I went out and I reported. I talked to a ton of people. I talked to surrogates of candidates. I talked to activists who are on the ground in some of the early states. And after all of that work, I was left with just one conclusion. This wasn't actually my choice to make. Historically, the editorial board has weighed in, citing the candidate it would prefer to win the party's nomination. And as I considered making an argument for just one candidate, the idea of picking a single person started to make less and less sense. What was clear in the aftermath of the 2016 election was that the Democratic Party is having an existential crisis. It's trying to determine what its future path should be, whether it's further to the left or further to the center. Is it going to be the party of the future, the party of John F. Kennedy, the party that takes the country and pushes forward groundbreaking ideas? Or is it going to be a party that returns America to stability, to bipartisanship, to working across the aisle, to getting things done? And I just increasingly felt like it wasn't the place of the New York Times editorial board to tell the Democratic Party where it ought to go. Instead, it was our job to give readers as much information as we could, to arm them as they head out to the polls, and to let them make their choice. I decided to listen to the board's vote and that we would endorse both Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar for the nomination. In this next section, you're going to hear me talk through my process with one of our producers, Phoebe Lett.
So, Katie, tell me how you made this decision.
It was hard. Coming out of the deliberations, there were really four candidates that I felt I could consider given the board's vote, which was Buttigieg, Booker, Warren, and Klobuchar. And then the Iran conflict happened. So I spent the first 2 weeks talking to a lot of smart people. I read through the transcripts as we were preparing them for publication. And then we had this standoff with Iran, and I was feeling so concerned about what was going to be happening in the Middle East. And so I talked it through with a couple of editors, and I sat down and worked on a draft of endorsing Joe Biden. And the reason why was really because he's been in the room for this kind of decision-making around foreign policy. When he came in, the parts where he was the strongest was when he talked about past decisions that he had made in the Obama administration and in the Senate
around foreign policy specifically. He had been one of the people questioning how many troops to send to Afghanistan and Iraq. And there's certain comfort in having someone who's done the job in the chair again. And I sat, you know, it was like this ridiculous draft, 2,000 words. I read through it and I was like, oh, you know, this is not a moment for comfortable. He just doesn't have the urgency to match what I personally feel like the country needs in terms of fixing what's broken. And that's because, for one, his policies are not very specific. There's this common theme of we're going to return to normal. And, like, obviously normal wasn't working for a lot of Americans in terms of them feeling disconnected from government. Two, he, on a lot of his policies, it feels like tinkering around the edges as opposed to a full-throated, like, we need to change. And even Amy Klobuchar has so much more of that in her, both the way she talks, but also in the plans that she set out. I mean, she has perhaps one of the most ambitious first 100-day plans that we've seen from candidates so far. And I also, just somewhat similar with Senator Sanders, worry about his health and his age and what it means to have someone who's approaching their 80s in the White House. And I don't think that, that's not like what changed my mind, but it is something that I was considering. We endorse Elizabeth Warren because of the urgency of the moment. We've lived through 3 years of a Trump administration that has really caused us to rethink a lot of the institutions and the norms that we as a board took for granted. We don't actually necessarily agree with a lot of the prescriptions that she's talking about. We've never backed Medicare for all. We don't believe in decriminalizing the border. We have a lot of misgivings around free college for all. But there's some power to how she talks about the problems that so many Americans are facing right now. And her plans are incredibly detailed for getting us to a place that makes the country more fair, freer, and hopefully healthier. So it just seemed like in this moment, despite our misgivings, it made sense to say this is an incredibly competent candidate for president and you really should consider her. And then we also endorsed Senator Klobuchar because she seemed to be making the best case for bipartisanship and unity in the U.S. And after 3 years of Donald Trump, I personally feel, and I think a lot of our board members feel, this tug towards someone who wants to be the president for the whole country again. And her plans are not as progressive as Elizabeth Warren's, but they're still really progressive. She would make meaningful strides on climate change, on healthcare with her public option plan, on the border, on improving our alliances with foreign governments again. And she talks about limiting military intervention, just like Bernie Sanders. Yet she does it in a way that I think a wider swath of voters are going to be able to relate to. One of the things that I found particularly appealing about Klobuchar is the way that she talks about really complex ideas. She brings them down to the human level. I love when she talks about climate change, for instance, because she relates it back to farming communities in Iowa or miners in northern Minnesota. It's not at the 30,000-foot level. She's not talking about deep science. It's all there. You know, she knows all of the facts and the figures and that she's making informed decisions. But she's able to talk about it in a way that the average person can understand why there's an impact to them and why we need to make a change.
So you went with two candidates. Has that ever happened before for the New York Times editorial board?
In fact, it has. In 1988, the board ran an endorsement for all three candidates in the race, Dukakis, Gore, and Jesse Jackson. And that was
a lot less satisfying, that editorial, because it was essentially vote for anyone but George H.W. Bush without the meatiness of explaining exactly why. We're saying these two women are the leading voices for two different paths that the Democratic Party could take going forward. They are quite different in how they would take the party forward, but not necessarily on the what. Either one would be extremely progressive, among the most progressive candidates that have ever, among the most progressive presidents ever. The reality is that what we're hearing from voters is they need this field to be narrowed in order to have a real conversation. And that's what we tried to do. The two-candidate endorsement wasn't unprecedented, but the world has had a lot to say about this decision.
Against all odds, yeah. The New York Times endorsement managed to be even dumber than we were all expecting.
Right. You can't choose one?
Just pitiful. I have to say, the dereliction here by the New York Times.
Yeah, I felt with this endorsement, or these two endorsements in general, were just a cop-out. And frankly, I think the pop and...
Some of the biggest criticism came from our own colleagues who host the Opinion Section's other podcast, The Argument.
Ross and Michelle, what was your initial reaction to the joint endorsement?
I mean, I kind of hated it, since we're being honest. I looked at it and said, okay, this means Biden is going to win.
Michelle?
Well, I was relieved that it wasn't Joe Biden. There was things in the endorsement that I thought were unfair. I thought some of the digs against Warren and also really against Bernie Sanders were a little unfair. But in terms of just advice to voters, it aligned with what I think.
What did you think, David?
It felt anticlimactic to not help voters choose between these two. And let's be clear, many voters aren't in a lane. They are trying to decide between Klobuchar and Warren or between Bernie and Biden.
Going into this, did you know people were going to hate your answer, whatever it was?
I absolutely knew that people were going to be unhappy with the fact that we selected two candidates to endorse. I think it's interesting that this has actually been a decision that has brought all haters. One of the more interesting themes to some of the critiques of it is that I've somehow belittled both of these women by refusing to choose one of them. It never even occurred to me that that's what people would think. I honestly never brought gender or race or sexuality into the picture as we were deciding who to endorse. I love that Democrats, this selection, have two strong women to choose from and have such a diverse field that they've been able to select from. I think for a lot of Democratic voters, the absolute central question is who can beat Donald Trump. We decided that that was impossible to know right now. 2016 taught us that we can't rely on polling to tell us who's the most electable. You see polls from Iowa still now where 43% of people are undecided about which candidate they want to back. You know, we decided instead we had to look very closely at the policy prescriptions that each candidate was selling to the voters, and we wanted to really think about how they would govern once they're in office.
Have you heard from either candidate since you endorsed them?
I didn't really expect to hear from either of them. One thing that happened after we announced the endorsement is Amy Klobuchar was endorsed by the Quad City Times, which is a local Iowa paper, and she and her team immediately pinned that to the top of her Twitter timeline. That endorsement stayed right there at the top, which I think is a good indication that Amy Klobuchar has her eye on the ball. Right now, her main priority needs to be speaking to Iowa and New Hampshire voters. And I think that hopefully will yield good things for her once the primaries and the caucuses begin. This concludes The Choice. We hope it gave you a fuller picture of each of these candidates vying for your vote. And now you have a choice to make. Register to vote in your state's primary and encourage everyone in your life to do the same. Get engaged, volunteer for a candidate, hold a voter registration drive in your neighborhood. There are so many ways you can be part of the political process in 2020. Keep the conversation going and talk to the people around you as we enter this primary season. We'll see you at the polls, and may the best woman win. Thanks for listening and sharing our episodes.
If you haven't heard every episode, go back and give them a listen. And for the deeply curious, check out the full transcripts of all of our interviews online at nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. And finally, to hear the rest of the debate with our colleagues on The Argument, head over to their feed and listen to the episode titled Why Endorse Two Candidates.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.
We saw the Des Moines Register endorse Elizabeth Warren. I think in a way we probably gave them permission to do that. Of course, they got to have a little bit of fun at our expense, but, you know, what a sick burn.
What did they say?
Something like, yes, this choice is very hard, but we did it. You know, we were able to pick one. It was pretty funny.
You got enough to do already? I do. That's why I use Shipt same day delivery to keep up with my busy life. They know the snacks I like down to the extra creamy in my peanut butter. I can get deliveries at home, on set, or even when I'm away on vacay. And my personal shopper, Amber, she's got my back. As in, she asked them to check the back if it's not on the shelf. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com/hi.